So this is the title of my talk, and try to do my best imitation of Sanskrit. The main points that I'll try to make in the talk today are that many non-commutative solitons of the kind that we've heard about in other talks, particularly that those constructed first by Gopal Kumar, Minwal, and Strominger, and the fluxons that other people have talked about and that David Gross didn't talk about but would have if he hadn't talked about something else, can be constructed in a unified way using a fairly simple but I think powerful idea, which I'll discuss. That this idea can be applied to the unstable D-brain systems with a non-zero B-field, which occur in string theory, and that this leads to a detailed description of lower dimensional D-brains as non-commutative solitons, thus confirming in a fairly detailed way part of the conjectures of Sen regarding tachyon condensation. And then finally, that the description of D-brain charge in this framework involves an example of something known as the K-theory of C-star algebras, BDF extension theory, and in general, a rich mathematical structure, most of which is probably not necessary at the current level of understanding, but some of which might be useful in later developments. And I'll say a few words about this. So this is an outline of my talk. Although there's been a lot of discussion of non-commutative geometry and field theory, I'll nonetheless review it just to set notation and emphasize a few points which haven't been mentioned by other speakers. I'll then go on to discuss a way of generating solutions, starting from simpler ones that can be used to construct non-commutative solitons in a kind of uniform way, or at least many of them. I'll discuss the application of tachyon condensation. I'll end with just a little bit of K-theory, just a little bit more because of lack of competence than lack of time. I'll only give a few references in the talk, but let me start out by saying that I think a lot of the motivation for this work comes from a combination of the work of Sen and Zwieback, which I remember was reported on at the Millennial Conference at Caltech a year ago. Some people were under the mistaken impression that the millennium started then, but anyway, this work has set the tone for a lot of developments over the last year. And then the paper by Gopal Kumar, Minwal, and Strominger, which introduced the idea of studying semi-classical solutions in non-commutative field theory, or at least revived and emphasized the interesting properties. And then these two ideas were combined by several groups, Dasgupta, Mukhi, and Rajesh, and then work I did in collaboration with Per Kraus, Finn Larson, and Emil Martinek, and then additional work by Ed Witten, who showed how to embed some of this into string field theory. And there's been a lot of work extending this to finite B field. This involved taking a limit of large B field and various kinds of gauge solutions. This is a very partial list of authors whose papers have been sort of most relevant to what I'm going to say. And then some of the K-theory aspects are in a paper I wrote with Greg Moore and some work by Ed Witten. The ones that I've underlined in green are the ones that I will follow in the presentation. All right, so non-commutative geometry, of course, arises in string theory, but prior to that, it really has its origin in quantum mechanics. And this has been referred to by many people, but let me say it again anyway. So going back to the very early days of quantum mechanics, Weyl suggested that one view the Heisenberg commutation relations as being defining a Lie algebra, and then one should exponentiate that to get a group element. And when you do that, the product of two group elements gives you a group element where you sum the parameters, but with a phase. And this means that we have a projective representation of the abelian group of translations in the R2 phase space. And this projective representation is really at the heart of non-commutative geometry, or at least one form of it as it's currently understood. And roughly speaking, in string theory, having a constant B field also leads to projective representations. And so there's a close relationship between these two facts. Now, there's a transformation that you can make between classical dynamical variables on phase space, functions of Q and P, and quantum mechanical operators called the Weyl transform. And it involves viewing operators as elements of the group algebra of this Weyl Heisenberg group. That is, you take an operator corresponding to a function f whose Fourier transform is f tilde, and you integrate it weighted by u of tau and sigma. Obviously, if we're in the classical regime and ignore the phase or set h bar to zero, then this just undoes the Fourier transform and reproduces the function f, but in the non-commutative framework, it gives us a non-trivial operator. And then you can invert this map to construct a function in terms of an operator, and I've chosen to write it in terms of the coordinate space matrix elements, but of course you could do it in momentum space as well. Now, this Weyl transform defines a non-commutative R2 because it defines a non-commutative deformation of the algebra of functions on R2. That is, the product of operators is non-commutative, and the product of the operators corresponding to the functions f and g is the operator corresponding to the star product of f with g, which I've written here. Here, xi are the coordinates on phase space, and I've chosen, and quantum mechanics corresponds to theta 1, 2 equal 1 with h bar equals 1. And in R2n, theta appearing here is simply the symplectic form. Now, it's possible to introduce derivatives in this language, which also goes back to Weyl. And the Weyl transform of the derivative of a function respect to q is the commutator of that operator with p hat. And similarly, the p derivative is the commutator with q hat. Or more generally, a derivative operator is minus I times the inverse of theta times the adjoint action of xi. And that obeys all the properties that a derivative operator should, linearity, the Leibniz rule, the derivative of x is delta, et cetera. Now, it's possible to relate the properties of these classical functions to the properties of operators. And in particular, there's a natural class of these functions where you bound the function and its derivatives by some constants times 1 plus x squared. I wrote x squared plus p squared. I should have written q squared plus p squared to a power. Labeled by m, and it's not too hard to show that if m is less than or equal to zero, that the corresponding operator is a bounded operator on Hilbert space, whereas if m is strictly negative, then the operator is a compact operator, which forms an ideal within the bounded operators. So we can define non-commutative field theories in terms of fields on a non-commutative space. I'm just doing the simplest case of R2n because that will be most relevant to the D-brain constructions that I want to discuss, with a star product of functions. Or as we've seen by the Weyl transform, that's equivalent to thinking of field theories where the fields are instead operators on Hilbert space. Or of course, we can think of that a la matrix theory as the n goes to infinity limit of n by n matrices. Now, you can consider non-commutative field theories without gauge fields, but it's a natural thing to do to include gauge fields, and that's something that appears in the D-brain context. And when you do that, you naturally gauge the group of unitary transformations on Hilbert space. So if I think of phi as being an operator in the adjoint representation, so to speak, that is, it would naturally transform as u phi u bar, where this is the adjoint operator, where u is an element of unitary transformations on Hilbert space, then we can introduce a covariant derivative in terms of a gauge field that transforms covariantly. And it's often useful to introduce complex coordinates or a set of complex coordinates since we're in even dimensional space, a creation operator, which is the complex coordinate rescaled by theta, and then to we can write the derivative using the previous formulae in terms of a commutator of a combination of this creation operator and the gauge field, and that linear combination is usually called C in the literature, and then in that notation, the field strength takes a very simple form. So by doing this, we can formulate non-commutative field theories that have a gauge symmetry, which is unitary transformations on Hilbert space. And if we have an action with this gauge symmetry, then the equations of motion will transform covariantly. And in seeing that it transforms covariantly, we only need that products of operators that transform covariantly themselves will transform covariantly. And that only requires that u bar u is equal to 1 because I have to get rid of these u bar u's in between this string. Now, if we had a finite dimensional symmetry group, then u bar u would equal to 1 would imply that u bar is equal to 1, but this is not true in infinite dimensions. It's not true for unitary transformations on Hilbert space. A transformation which has u bar u equals 1 but u bar not equal to 1 will take a solution to a gauge inequivalent solution, because the equations of motion transform covariantly, and therefore solutions will map to solutions, but it will be a gauge inequivalent solution, since if u bar is not equal to 1, u is not a gauge symmetry. Now, what kind of transformations do this? Well, if u bar u is equal to 1, then it implies that u bar squares to itself, so u bar has to be a projection operator. And a little nomenclature, if u bar u is equal to 1, it's called an isometry because it preserves the inner product or the metric on Hilbert space. So the conclusion of this little argument is that an isometry which is not unitary, there won't be a gauge transformation because it's not unitary, but it will nonetheless take solutions to solutions of the classical equations of motion and therefore generate gauge inequivalent solutions to the equations of motion. And the canonical example of one of these non-unitary isometries is the shift operator. If n is a basis for our separable Hilbert space, you can think of it as the simple harmonic oscillator eigenstates, then the operator which takes n and shifts it up by 1 obeys s bar to the n, s n is equal to 1, but s n, s bar to the n is equal to 1 minus a projection operator onto the first n levels of Hilbert space. So, although it's possible to find solutions sort of without using this idea, this is a simple way of finding solutions, which is quite powerful and much easier than trying to do explicit manipulations. And I want to illustrate it with a few examples. So let's consider a non-commutative theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Time will be commutative, but the two spatial coordinates will obey commutator of x1 with x2 is I theta. And we can take an action which involves a gauge field, its kinetic energy term, and a coupling to a scalar field. We would formulate this in terms of non-commutative geometry, in terms of a star product, or we could use operator language. If we do that, then the energy in operator language involves a trace over the Hilbert space of this quantity here, and I've replaced, for a static configuration, I dropped the time dependence, and I've replaced the gauge field and derivatives by C. Now, with an unstable D-brain in mind later on, we could choose the potential to have a maximum at 0 and a minimum at phi star. So we'd have a vacuum configuration where the gauge fields were 0 and the scalar field was just phi star. So it's just a completely constant field configuration, no gauge fields. And we can now act with our canonical non-unitary isometry, which is the nth power of the shift operator, and doing so generates a new solution, where phi is phi star times 1 minus a projection operator, and C is the gauge transform of A bar. This solution, if we translate it back into functions on a non-commutative space, is a lump. It's localized near the origin in some convenient basis and has excitations of the scalar fields and the gauge fields, which are localized. It carries flux, which you compute in a straightforward way, and it has energy, one term coming from the potential term, which depends, as is the case in this business, only on the value of the potential at the maximum, and then a term coming from the gauge field energy. So let me make a few comments about this solution. It reduces to various other solutions in the literature and various limits. So if we take phi star equal to 0 and forget about the potential, then this just reduces to the pure gauge fluxon solution, which other people have discussed. If we drop the gauge fields as theta goes to infinity, then this reduces to the GMS soliton with the scalar field proportional to a projection operator. And this can all be trivially extended to R2n just by taking theta to be a 2n by 2n antisymmetric matrix. And the divergence of the energy as theta goes to 0 here is as expected by Dirac's theorem, which tells us that in arbitrary numbers and dimensions, in a commutative theory, we should not be able to find finite energy solutions. Now, in this example, I was imagining taking the scalar field to be real, or in operator language, taking the operator to be Hermitian. There is an interesting generalization of this, where we consider non-Hermitian operators, or non-complex scalar fields. And it's natural in that case to promote the gauge symmetry to a product of unitary transformations on Hilbert space with two gauge fields, A plus and A minus. This leads to vortex solutions. So a typical action would have kinetic terms for the A plus and A minus gauge fields, kinetic energy terms for some scalar field, and then we can make various choices for the potential. I've chosen the potential to be this sort of Mexican hat or wine bottle shape with a ring of minimum at phi bar equal to 1. Now, this theory has a gauge symmetry where we can take different unitary transformations acting on phi on the left and the right and similarly transform the A plus and A minus gauge fields, or here I've written it in terms of C plus and minus, these combinations of derivatives plus gauge fields. And again, the argument that if we find a non-unitary isometry, it will take a solution to a solution goes through. And so we can choose U to be an nth power of the shift operator, V to be the nth power. And that generates from the vacuum solution phi equals 1, a solution where phi is equal to S to the M, S bar to the N, and the gauge fields have this form. And this corresponds to N vortices and M antivortices of the broken U1. So this construction of solutions doesn't require taking any large non-commutivity limit. If you recall from GMS, where there weren't any gauge fields, you find simple solutions for large non-commutivity, but at finite theta, it's a rather involved affair. So one point of this is that when you include gauge fields, going to finite non-commutivity is a rather trivial generalization of what you know how to do at large non-commutivity. So given these two examples of finding solutions in non-commutative field theory, we can try to extend these ideas to the non-commutative field theories which arise in unstable brain systems in a B field. That is either D anti-D or unstable D brains in type 2 or just any D brain in the bosonic string. Now, the derivation of non-commutative geometry from string theory is a long story, which I think you're all familiar with, so I will not go through that. I'll just summarize it here. There's a freedom in the choice of description, which involves a two-form phi, and the phi equals minus B convention, which was discussed by Seiberg and Witten, and then in more detail by Seiberg, is a very convenient one. And when you do that, the parameters determining appearing in the open string field theory are a non-commutivity parameter theta, which is 1 over B, an open string metric, which is related to B in the closed string metric G in this fashion, and a coupling constant, capital G sub S, which is related to the closed string coupling, little g sub S, and B and G in this way. So if we want to apply these ideas, we can start looking at various unstable brain systems. And because the generalization is really quite straightforward, I'll just do an example. So let's take the D25 brain in the bosonic string. This has a tachyon field, and a lot of evidence from level truncation that we've heard indicates that the potential for phi has a maximum, which corresponds to the unstable D25 brain, and then a minimum, which corresponds to the closed string vacuum. So if we want to try to describe lower D brains as solitons when the tachyon condenses, that is some kind of finite energy configuration which is asymptotic to the closed string vacuum, we can do that in this language by turning on a B field transverse to the D brain that we want to construct. So the simplest example would be to turn on a B field in two dimensions to try and construct a D23 brain. And although it is possible to make some progress on this in string field theory, I'll imagine that we integrate out all the massive modes of the string in order to obtain effective action for the tachyon and the gauge field on the D25 brain. Now, we don't know that effective action in detail, but we can work out some of the lowest order terms. There are some prefactors which come from this recipe for writing down the action in terms of the appropriate coupling constant and metric. And then there will be kinetic terms for the gauge fields, and F plus phi always appears together. There will be kinetic energy terms for the tachyon field. There will be a potential for the tachyon, and then there will be an infinite number of higher derivatives terms, which we really don't know very much about, but luckily won't be necessary to know much about them. So the two points that are important are that there's a coefficient multiplying the kinetic energy term for the gauge field in this effective action approach, which vanishes in the closed string background. in the closed string vacuum. And that has been, evidence for that has come both from conformal field theory and from boundary string field theory. And then the fact that we know the value of the potential at its maximum, or rather the difference between the maximum and the minimum, which is Senn's conjecture, and we've heard much evidence that that's correct. So this is a non-commutative field theory of the kind that we discussed before, except that we have changed it around a little bit by putting some prefactors, and there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about that involves higher derivatives. But the argument that we can generate a solution was only based on the covariance of the action, or the invariance of the action under gauge transformations, in particular under almost gauge transformations, these non-unitary isometries. And that doesn't depend upon the details of these functions or the higher derivative terms. So we can apply the same argument. We can start with the vacuum where phi is equal to 1 and the gauge field is 0. That's the closed string vacuum. And we can act on that with the nth power of the shift operator as an almost gauge transformation to construct a solution where phi is 1 minus a rank n projection operator and the gauge fields have this form. This is the localized solution. It's asymptotic to the closed string vacuum. And we haven't had it to take any limit here of the non-commutivity. We can compute the energy of this, even though we don't know the full action, by noting the following. First of all, covariant derivative of phi and the covariant derivative of the gauge field both vanish. That's because they vanish in the vacuum and they transform covariantly under this solution generating transformation. So if they start out 0, they end up 0. So they vanish in the vacuum. Similarly, the kinetic energy term for the gauge field has the form of this function h of phi minus 1 times the commutator c with c bar squared. And if you work that out, it involves the projection operator times 1 minus the projection operator, which is 0. So this, plus the higher order terms that don't involve derivatives of the gauge field, but just higher powers of the gauge field from the DBI action, also do not contribute to the action, or to the energy. So all the higher derivative terms, since they involve higher covariant derivatives, vanish. The kinetic term for the gauge field vanishes, and only the potential term is left to contribute, just as it did in the limit of large non-commutivity. And calculating the tension shows that the solution has precisely n times the tension of a D23 brain. So it's likely that this describes n D23 brains, and that can be verified by a more detailed analysis. In particular, as in the analysis that was in this original paper, the spectrum of fluctuations includes UN gauge fields and a tachyon field in the adjoint representation, as we would expect for ND23 brains. And it gives a new insight onto the non-abelian gauge symmetry. Here it really is arising as a UN subgroup of the group of unitary transformations on Hilbert space. This improves on the earlier treatments in that we don't need to take this limit. This limit, for one thing, was problematic in that in order to obtain a finite open string coupling, you had to take the closed string coupling to 0. So this is not necessary in the current treatment, and hence we can describe D brains as solitons even at finite closed string coupling. And although I won't go through it, the analysis is easily extended to other systems, for example, the unstable D brains in type 2 or the D9 anti-D9 systems in 2B or 2A using the appropriate non-commutative field theory, and there's been a lot of discussion of these aspects in the literature. It takes the field theories of the form I had, generalizes them as for the D25 brain, but in a way that's motivated by conformal field theory and boundary string field theory arguments, and shows that the various conjectures that Senn made about how one constructs unstable and stable D brains as solitons all follow quite directly in this non-commutative framework. All right, so let me say a few words about K-theory. I do this with some trepidation since I know there are many people in the audience that know a lot more about it than I do, but nonetheless. So until a few years ago, when we would try to describe the charges of solitons in field theory, or in string theory for that matter, the basic tools of algebraic topology, that is homotopy, homology, and cohomology, have been sufficient to compute the charges. If we wanted to be fancy, these tools or functors from the category of topological spaces to the category of abelian groups, but all that means is that it's a natural way of taking a topological space and assigning some charges to it. That's what an abelian group is. We can add up charges. Now, with the advent of D-brains, we've had to generalize this so that we include spaces with vector bundles, since there's naturally a gauge theory on the D-brain, and find a natural way of assigning abelian groups to this kind of structure, and that's one definition of K-theory, and it arose through the work of these people in string theory. Now we have a further way of thinking about D-brains and non-commutative solitons in general, and we need some kind of non-commutative algebraic topology. Now, this is a subject which has been well developed in the mathematical literature, and I'll just say a few words about it. So non-commutative solitons can be constructed in terms of operators, and more generally, we'll be interested then in some kind of C-star operator algebra, and we want a way to assign charges to these beasts, that is, an abelian group. This leads to something called the K-theory of C-star algebras. Let me just say a few words about this in a simple example. So in constructing a D7 from a D9 anti-D9, which I did not do, but I can appeal to the earlier field theory, which is very similar, if we want a single D7 rather than n D7s and m anti-D7s, we would take the tachyon field on this D9 anti-D9 system to be the shift operator, or proportional to the shift operator, and then there'd be some gauge fields in the way that I described. Now, in a commutative theory, we would compute the charge of the D7 brain using homotopy theory. In particular, we'd have a formula like this, which said that the charge was the winding number of the tachyon field, the integral over a circle at infinity of phi bar d phi with some appropriate normalization. And the charges would be labeled by pi 1 of S1. Now, instead, we have an operator, the shift operator, and the charge should be related to the index. So one way to see this, or at least to appeal to known mathematical results to see this, is to consider first a generalization of the shift operator, where we take our Hilbert space not to have a basis of harmonic oscillator eigenstates, but we think of our Hilbert space as being square integrable functions on the circle, and an orthonormal basis consists of wave functions e to the I and theta over square root of 2 pi, now with n running over all integers, not just positive integers. And if we have a function on the circle, that is an element of the algebra of functions on S1, which I'll call C naught of S1, it determines an operator on H in the obvious way, that is, to distinguish the function from the operator, I'll call the operator M sub F, and it acts by multiplying psi of theta by F of theta. So for example, if f is just e to the I theta, that takes psi n to psi n plus 1, as the shift operator does. But since n runs over all integers and not just positive integers, this operator has index 0. So to get an analog of the shift operator in this setup, roughly speaking, we're trying to think of this circle as being like the circle at infinity that we use to measure homotopy. We can let H plus be a subspace of the Hilbert space spanned by the psi n's with n non-negative, and let P be the projection operator onto the subspace. So in this way, we can generalize the shift operator as follows. We define an operator called a Toeplitz operator, or Toeplitz, Toeplitz, Toeplitz. I don't know quite how it's pronounced, but anyway, something like that, which is an operator from H plus to H plus, we first multiply by a function. Now, of course, in general, that will take us out of H plus because the function can have both positive and negative frequency bits, and then we brutally truncate by projecting back to H plus, and that defines an operator. It generalizes the shift operator. For example, the Toeplitz operator that corresponds to e to the I L theta is just acts as isomorphic to the Lth power of the shift operator acting on H plus. And there's an index theorem for these Toeplitz operators due to Venugopal Krishna. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right either, but that relates the index of this Toeplitz operator to the winding number of f in the way that we would expect. So this makes the connection between the winding number of f, which we view as the charge in the commutative theory, and the index of an operator, which is how the charge arises in the non-commutative framework. Now, this example also provides one of the simplest examples of a more elaborate and deeper theory, which is necessary, at least in mathematics, when one wants to generalize these ideas. I think it's not completely clear yet whether it's absolutely necessary in string theory. And this is part of what's known as the extension theory of Brown-Douglas-Fillmore and various other things. So I'll just say one word about that, so that if it turns out you might need something like this in the future, you at least know where to look. So if we look at these tuplets operators, it's pretty clear, perhaps by going back and thinking about the definition of compact operators that I gave previously, that if you take the product of TF, TG minus the tuplets operator corresponding to the product of F times G, that that's a compact operator. For example, a very simple computation is to work out this product, FL, FL star, where FL is e to the IL theta, minus T of the identity, and see that that's just a projection operator on the first L states. So we have a map that tells us how to take a tuplets operator and map it to a function on the circle. That is, T sub F goes to F, so these tuplets operators form a C star algebra. The functions on a circle are a C star algebra. We have a map, and this fact tells us that the kernel of this map is the compact operators, since when I map to the C star algebra of functions on the circle, this is a commutative algebra, and this is trivial. So since the kernel is the compact operators, we can say that what we have, therefore, is a short exact sequence with the tuplets algebra lying in between the C star algebra of functions on the circle and the compact operators. And the classification of these extensions with this tuplets algebra replaced by a general C star algebra is this extension theory of Brown, Douglas, and Fillmore, and related to various things known in terms of K-homology. Now, I'm not going to discuss precisely how this arises. Roughly, you find an invariant of these extensions, which has a fairly clear physical meaning in terms of looking at sort of the asymptotic form of the operator in terms of how its bounded properties quotiented by the compact operators, which discuss fluctuations on the D-brain. And then you find that you can give an abelian group structure to these extensions, which defines this fancier version of K-theory. So I guess I've gone kind of quickly, and I can either spend 5 minutes saying more about K-theory, but I won't, since I probably shouldn't. And I'll just end a little bit early with questions, and then I'd be happy to take any other questions that you have. So rather than summarizing, I mean, I guess I could summarize by saying that non-commutative field theory in solitons provides a rather precise way of testing some of Sen's conjectures regarding tachyon condensation, something that's also been tested fairly precisely now using boundary string field theory. But I think open questions that are interesting are whether these techniques of non-commutative geometry can be used to study the really hard problems in tachyon condensation, such as the emergence of closed strings. Various groups have tried to describe closed strings in terms of flux tubes in this non-commutative geometry, including original work with Krauss, Larson, and Martinek, but I don't think anybody has really done so in a completely satisfactory way that allows us to understand in a concrete way where the closed strings are coming from. This solution generating technique is, I think, rather nice, and it would be nice if it could be extended to other situations. It really relies on having an infinite dimensional symmetry group, and any time there's an infinite dimensional symmetry group, we might think that we could use this idea. Now, one example where there's an infinite dimensional symmetry group is the cubic open string field theory, and it's tempting to think that you should construct the string field corresponding to a D-brain by acting with the solution generating transformation, that is some non-unitary isometry, on the string field that corresponds to the vacuum. And, I think this might actually be true, but as I've come to realize by talking to various people, it's really not very clear how you would carry this out, what this means. It's hindered by our lack of understanding of global gauge transformations in string field theory. We really only understand them for infinitesimal gauge transformations. But I think this is an interesting avenue to pursue, and some similar proposals regarding the vacuum have been made in a paper by Schnabel. And then finally, the mathematical framework that I discussed at the end leads into some very rich and beautiful mathematics. It's not completely clear to me whether it's required in order to discuss D-brains in the most general way, but certainly having a B-field is generic, and so the whole framework of non-commutative field theory and K-theory of operator algebras is bound to be part of the eventual general framework that we use to understand D-brains. And if involved in understanding D-brains in more general situations involves more general C-star algebras, then some of the mathematics that I just very briefly sketched at the end is likely to play a role in understanding how to generalize topological notions to that situation and understand what the possible charges of D-brains are. So I'll stop there.
Okay, so we have time for several questions.
Is a C-star algebra just a Banach space equipped with a continuous product, or is there some other requirement?
Is there another question?
Well, if you don't want to answer that one, could you at least tell me why are C-star algebras always the things that turn up in considerations of non-commutative field theories?
Well, I think there's a theorem that says that any C-star algebra is a subalgebra of the algebra of bounded operators on Hilbert space. So it's a very natural thing to occur, since in a non-commutative framework, one way of formulating that is in terms of operators on Hilbert space, and obviously demanding that operators be bounded is something that has physical significance. So I think it appears simply because we're looking at subspaces of the possible operators on Hilbert space that satisfy certain conditions.
Thanks.
You described one class of solutions in these non-commutative field theories you got using your solution generating techniques. Mm-hmm. Are there other solutions? Do we know these are if these are D-brains and there are others, that might be interesting, but maybe there aren't.
Well, you can certainly apply this idea to other sorts of solutions. It has been applied, for example, to trying to look for solutions to the anti-self dual equations. It certainly doesn't give all solutions. For example, if you try to apply it to looking for anti-self-dual equations, you can construct them if the non-commutivity parameter is also anti-self-dual, but the hard and interesting case where they have the opposite duality, is, as far as I know, cannot be constructed using these ideas. So I don't know. I mean, it's not completely general. There are many interesting solutions that can't be found this way, but it appears that many of the cases that are most relevant to D-brains can be found in this way. And I don't know whether there are other more exotic things. I mean, there have been some additional papers in the literature, but without going into more detail about exactly who did what, I don't think I can make a general statement.
Thank you.
Could you comment on the appearance of NS5 brains in this non-commutative framework?
Well, since NS5 brains have a tension that goes like 1 over the closed string coupling squared, they're clearly most naturally thought of as solitons in the closed string sector rather than solitons in the open string sector, like D-brains. So I don't think we really expect to find them in the same way until we have a concrete way of understanding how closed strings arise. Now, I think it is possible that we can try to describe D-brains as non-commutative solitons in the background of a NS5 brain. And in this paper that I wrote with Greg, we, based on some extensions of previous work that people had done on non-zero H-fields, we proposed that involved non-trivial bundles, basically non-trivial bundles of Hilbert spaces that you should look at unitary transformations on Hilbert space mod an overall U1, and that having an NS5 brain corresponded to having a non-trivial element of pi 2 of that space. And I think that is correct, although the details are complicated and it hasn't really been used so far to do anything terribly interesting. But I think it should be possible to extend this to certain backgrounds that include NS5 brains, but constructing the 5 brains directly as solitons seems to me that something that one is not supposed to do, at least in a naive way, in open string theory.
Yes. Can you indicate to what extent your results are classical and to what extent quantum corrections can be taken into account?
Well, the results I've discussed are completely classical. They're based on looking for solutions to the, or semi-classical, looking for solutions to the classical equations of motion. It might be an interesting thing to do to try to study the question of quantum corrections, but I haven't done that and don't have anything useful to say about it.
Could you please comment on whether non-commutativity would help in understanding topology-changing transformations?
That sounds like a fascinating idea, but I don't have anything to say about it.
Can you comment on the theta goes to zero limit of these solitons and the relation to deep brains without non-commutativity?
I don't think I can say anything other than what we've discussed previously. One would like these to go over to usual D-brains in that limit, but you lose control of these techniques for finding exact solutions in that limit. Presumably that means that the change of variables from these non-commutative variables to those that are used in boundary string field theory or in cubic string field theory is perhaps rather singular in that limit, although presumably, you know, the physical description is continuous, even though the variables you use might have to change in a rather drastic way. It would be interesting to try and understand that in more detail, but again, I don't.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's thank the speaker again.